I'm Rick Gantley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Earlier this month, the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News presented an in-depth series on drunk driving. The series began with some shocking numbers. More than 14,600 Granite Staters are repeat offenders when it comes to this crime. In other words, they've been caught and convicted of driving under the influence at least twice, and in some cases, a lot more. The series looked at why that's the case, why so many New Hampshire drivers with multiple offenses are still getting behind the wheel, and it offered a number of solutions to curb that trend, from tougher laws to more substance abuse treatment. Finally, the paper told of the human toll drunk driving continues to have on our communities and families, stories of Granite Staters who made one bad decision to drink and drive and ended up killing themselves or someone else. Today in The Exchange, DWI in New Hampshire. We examine the many topics raised in this series, and let's hear from you. Do you have personal experience with this issue? And given that, what do you think is the best way to address this problem? And even if it hasn't touched you directly, why do you think we still see so many people drinking and driving, even after so many years of attention to it? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and comment there. Our guests are three people who've looked at this matter for a long time. They are Bob Kelly, director of the Amethyst Foundation, a nonprofit that offers substance abuse education, intervention, and evaluation. Bob, nice to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Also with us, Jim Reams, Rockingham County Attorney and President of the National District Attorneys Association. And Jim Reams, welcome back to you, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
And also with us, John Thal, New Hampshire Republican Representative from Whitefield, sponsor of legislation addressing impaired driving. John Thal is also a former state trooper. And Representative Thal, good to see you, too. Thank you.
Glad to be back.
Well, and Jim Reams, I'll start with you, but I want to hear from everyone. You know, there's been so much public awareness for this, at least for the past 20 years. So much, Jim, of an active Don't Drink and Drive campaign, designated drivers on New Year's Eve and on, sobriety checkpoints. Why are we still seeing so many people taking the chance and driving while intoxicated?
Well, society really hasn't made the decision to take this as serious as it needs to be. We've made lots of progress over the last 20 years, I would say, with the attitudes towards drinking and driving, but we still have a ways to go. I mean, compared to European countries or many other states in this nation, New Hampshire doesn't treat it as harshly as many other places. So
now, I'm surprised to hear you say that because, you know, to the uninitiated, it sure looks like we've been paying attention. Again, you know, you've got sobriety checkpoints on St. Patrick's Day and New Year's Eve. You've got massive Don't Drink and Drive campaigns in the schools and out in the public. So seems like we're taking this pretty seriously. What more could we do?
Well, the piece of it that's missing, I think we would probably all agree, is we don't have treatment, for one thing, that is on a level that we need. When you have 14,000 repeat offenders in this state, that tells you something is, you know, failing in our system.
What do you think, Representative Thal? Why are we still here talking about this?
Well, I think human nature looks at this a little differently than they used to. 40 years ago, obviously, it was here but the grace of God go I, and, you know, just everybody does it, and the BAC was 1.5, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So education has done a lot, but without treatment, we can't correct or change the people's mindset. And we don't, unfortunately, have the funding to do that. Hopefully, one of the bills that's going to be heard in the Senate next week is going to mandate more evaluation and more treatment and link it to license return to continuing getting treatment. There's some funding, probably not enough, and it probably won't be ongoing long enough, but it's a start. And I know I've been fighting for treatment for the 14 years I've been in the legislature.
Well, and it's interesting what you say, Representative Thal, about the change in attitudes. I think you were quoted in the Union Leader as saying that in the 1970s, you know, you'd see drunk drivers bouncing from snowbank to snowbank, and people just laughed it off.
That's true. You could find them almost anywhere in the early 70s. They were not unusual to find them plowing snow during the wintertime or, you know, that kind of thing. And
wow.
That type has gone away pretty much. You still see it every now and again, but that extreme is gone. But there's still people out there who are extremely dangerous.
So we've gotten more serious, but perhaps not serious enough. And I'm curious what you think, Bob Kelly. You know, again, lots of attention, lots of toughening up of the laws. The blood alcohol content level that used to be acceptable is no longer acceptable. So why haven't we, if not solved this, at least figured it out?
Well, I think there are a number of variables, but I just wanted to comment on the plowing story. As a young man, I worked for the Manchester Highway Department, we had a gentleman do his whole route without putting the plow down. He was so drunk. So,
wow.
You know, that's obviously dramatically changed over the years. I think we have had a great deal of effect. When I began in this field in 81, I believe the convictions were around 9,000 a year, and now they're lower than 4,000. So there's been an impact, in my opinion, on the social drinker, the person who sees the change in law, sees the change in the tenor of the approach, and says, I can't afford to do this anymore. What is the difficulty is that the population that we're dealing with, the first and to a greater extent second offenders, have a multiple number of problematic characteristics, and it's very difficult to address that because of the number of those characteristics. And I think what Attorney Thole was saying is if we can get that treatment, if we can identify first that person who's at highest risk to recidivate, and then secondly, tailor the treatment to that person, that's when we're going to have the greatest impact.
Okay, and everybody's talked about treatment, so I should ask you, Bob, since this is your area, how much of drunk driving is a crime of a one-time stupid mistake, you know, at the bachelor party or, you know, night out with friends, and how much is this about serious alcoholism?
Well, ironically, it's a two-pronged trait, I guess, or two traits that you'd see. One is the presence of a significant substance-related disorder. I mean, now we're seeing almost all of the people coming through with alcohol and drug use issues. So it's no longer, and I think probably Attorney Reams would say the same thing, that it's, you know, we're not seeing simple alcohol offenders anymore. But I think it has to do with alcoholism and drug abuse, and it also has to do with unique personality or lifestyle traits that are resistant to change. The profile of the repeat offender isn't just an alcoholic. I mean, we know that from research that it's a subpopulation of that group.
So what do you think, Jim Reams? I mean, of the nearly 96,000 people with a DWI conviction, more than 60,000 were first-time offenders. So what does that say to you? Does that say, you know, a lot of people are just making one bad mistake, or is that saying that we have a serious problem with, you know, hardcore alcoholics taking the wheel?
Well, I think it demonstrates the initial bad decision to drink and drive is one level of problem. And my complaints about the system are as we have multiple convictions, what the system fails to do is to ramp up the requirements for treatment, the requirements for prison, whatever it takes to be able to try and solve that problem. You know, when you get to the 14,000 repeat offenders, that's 14,000 people that we can identify fairly easily that are a threat to the rest of us on the highways.
Yeah, I have to say, Representative Thole, I found that 14,600 number just shocking. Repeat offenders, at least two convictions, possibly three, sometimes four, you know, five, six, seven, eight. There was one guy who had 12. And, you know, you just read that and you go, how can these people be allowed to get behind the wheel again? It just seems mind-boggling.
Most of them aren't. They drive without a license. They drive under suspension. They do that. And the penalty for driving after a suspension for DWI is not as harsh as it could be. It's 7 days in jail. That came about because the courts were saying at one time that once the DWI suspension ran, that if they didn't have their license back, it was just a simple operating after suspension, so it was a $100 fine. We had to change the law to say that if you're under for DWI, you're under for DWI until you get your license back.
So that's not enough?
Probably,
is that in your opinion?
Probably not. There are several things I would like to see changed. It's difficult when you have a legislature that is as large as ours to get things through.
That's by design, isn't it?
Probably to a certain extent, yes. I probably think it is, because otherwise there would be a lot of things go through that we really don't want to see go through.
But in this instance, there's some serious changes you feel need to be made, Representative Fall, to really get serious about, you know, multiple offenders getting behind the wheel again.
Yes, I do. I think all three of us here have the same philosophy that we want to get people off the road that shouldn't be on the road, get them treatment, get their habits changed, and motivate them to do the right thing so that people are going to be safe on the roads.
I can tell you want to jump in, Bob Kelly. Go ahead.
Well, no, I just want to follow up on that. I think you've asked the question, what percentage of how frequent is it that a person has a significant substance-related disorder?
And right. Are we talking bad mistakes or are we talking serious substance abuse?
Well, my experience and the literature suggests that we're dealing with a population that has both serious alcohol-related problems, even with the first offense. Now, I'm not saying everyone. There are certainly first offenders who have made a mistake, but it's a small population compared to the overall numbers. There are national studies saying 5% of the people do not have significant problems. So we're seeing a population that is the least likely to be able to self-regulate. And then we have within that population people who have attitudes that are, mental health issues, risk-taking behavior issues, whether it's alcohol or drug, oppositional attitudes. And
oppositional attitudes means defiant. I can do what
exactly,
I want.
Exactly. Yeah. And they have, criminal histories. So there's a population. But even our first offenders have had many DWIs.
All right. Well, we will talk more after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls. Join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We'll be right back.
Good morning. It's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members. Support also comes to us from Warren Street Architects, an employee-owned cooperative, providing thoughtful planning, innovative design, and respectful collaboration for the built environment. More at warrenstreet.coop. And from Elliott Urgent Care in downtown Manchester, an alternative to an emergency department for accidents, illnesses, and injuries, or when your doctor's office is closed. Elliott'sRiversEdge.org. More on the problem of drunk driving in New Hampshire on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, a wrap-up of Supreme Court arguments on the Affordable Care Act. New Hampshire weather today, cloudy with some scattered showers for most of the state. North Country could see some scattered snow showers. Highs today around 40 north, 45 to 50 in the rest of the state. For tonight, clearing, lows near 20 north in New Hampshire, 25 to 30 across the rest of the state. And tomorrow, mostly sunny, seasonable temperatures. Highs from 40 north, ranging to 50 in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking again at the longtime problem of drunk driving, following up on a major series in the New Hampshire Union Leader this month. We invite you to join us. Do you have personal experience with this issue? What do you think might be the best way to address this problem? And even if it hasn't touched you directly, why do you think we still see so many people drinking and driving even after society has been paying so much attention to this over the years? Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page, join the conversation there. With me in studio, three gentlemen who've been looking at this for a long time: State Representative John Thall from Whitefield. He's also a former state trooper. Jim Reams, Rockingham County Attorney, and Bob Kelly, Director of the Amethyst Foundation. Again, that number is 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones. And Andrea's calling in first from Tuftonboro. Hi, Andrea. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I think your guests are great and right on. And I do want to say that I think your campaign for drunk driving does work. the population that they're speaking of are probably more serious, like, you know, you were just saying, with real using issues and habits that they can't drop. But I'm an entertainer, and this is really the reason why I called, because I deal with this issue in the bars where I play music in the Lakes region, and we are a tourist industry environment here. So what happens, I see, is the campaign for drunk driving is so good that lots of people won't come out. And then when they don't come out on New Year's Eve, then I lose my job.
Wow. So, Andrew, what are you saying? What are you saying? Are you saying we're too tough?
Or bad. I think, no, I'm really not. But I'm saying it is working. People actually do think about drinking and driving.
Yeah.
And, you know, on Facebook, for instance, for New Year's, there was a local guy who hangs out at a local bar, and he was carpooling people, you know, around.
So you're seeing it in that sort of bar nightclub scene. You're seeing a real awareness. And you think that's a good thing, Andrea?
Absolutely. I do think that the population that they're talking about are the real, you know, people with serious issues of alcoholism, who are those, I don't know my terms for, but I'm listening to your show. But what I'm seeing is really a local, regular moms and dads and the tour, you know, they think about it. They really do.
Okay.
And I think the bartenders are doing a great job, too.
Well, this is a good point, the bartenders. And this has come up, Jim Reams, hasn't it? You know, I was reading some about this again in the Union Leader series. Bars and restaurants are under a lot more pressure these days to keep an eye on the clientele.
Yeah, we've prosecuted four separate bars and restaurants in Rockingham County for, you know, serving obviously intoxicated patrons, which all resulted in accidents with serious injury or death.
Wow.
And all of them have pled guilty on a negotiated basis.
So what do the rules say?
Well, they're trained not to serve people who are clearly intoxicated. It's always been illegal in New Hampshire to do that. We just have heightened awareness. Video cameras in the bars and restaurants are a great tool for us. Most of the cases that we've prosecuted, we've had video evidence of, you know, people getting served when they could hardly sit on a bar stool.
Wow.
Well, but it's funny, in Portsmouth, to follow up on what Andrea said, the police department, due to budget cuts, pulled a lot of the officers out of downtown Portsmouth. What they found on the weekend was that assaults went up by, I think it was over 1,000% at the end of the evening when the people were coming out of the bars. I mean, it was just a huge increase just because there wasn't a police officer that they could see when they came out of the bar.
Well, here's
so
the question, though.
Trying to adjust to that.
It's tricky, though. I mean, I definitely the person who can barely sit on the bar stool, but I feel kind of bad for the busy bartender who's got, you know, a crowded scene there, and he or she is supposed to discern each individual person's individual condition. Also, you know, I could buy a drink for a friend and carry it over to their table, and maybe that friend has already had four, you know, so it's really hard to assess blame sometimes.
It can be, but the only ones that we prosecute and have prosecuted are the ones that are just so obvious that, you know, we feel confident we put it in front of a jury, they're going to convict. You know, like I said, we have video evidence. One of the first ones in Portsmouth was Fat Bellies, and the guy had $96 worth of drinks and was drunk enough to put a $100 tip on it.
$96 worth of drinks just for himself?
Yes.
Okay, that's a lot of drinks.
You know, he may have given one away to somebody. We don't know. But we have video of him being shut off in other bars and then coming back to Fat Bellies to get more.
Well, that's the hard thing, too, is, you know, you think I only served him two, but you don't know how much he had at the place across the street. Right. Bob Kelly, jump in. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I hate to admit to this, but I was a bartender in my mid-20s in Manchester, and it was relatively easy to identify the people at the bar who were impaired. The difficulty was in monitoring. It was mostly waitresses in those days. And their livelihood depended on good tips. Good tips depended on oftentimes impaired clients.
Well, and the more drinks you buy, the bigger your bill is, and you're doing it as a percentage.
And the more impaired you are, the larger your tip is generally going to be. So it was difficult even in those days to monitor both the consuming, you know, the patron consuming it, and also the waitresses who, if you'd say, you got to be careful about this guy, would, you know, they'd be upset that their livelihood was being threatened. So there are a lot of layers to that. However, I do think, and I agree completely with Jim, that if you monitor those things, and if you monitor, for example, what you were saying, a person's the number of drinks they've purchased, et cetera, and you're vigilant about that, it's not it's a pretty relatively easy task to do if you're vigilant.
Well, and Andrea's right. There is a lot more attention. Andrea, thanks for the call. Representative Thole, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I think the Liquor Commission, the Enforcement Bureau, does a very good job of training the help that's in the establishments, not just bars and restaurants, but in package stores and other things. And they take very good enforcement action if they find that someone is selling to somebody who, I mean, I know a store that had a fine of about $500 because they served somebody who sold a six-pack to somebody who had a 0.26 BAC as they drove out of the store. So
BAC,
I mean,
is blood alcohol content, 0.26 being a lot.
Very much, yes.
Right.
I mean, they do a very good job of training and enforcement.
Let's take another call. Again, Andrew, thanks for that one. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Wayne is waiting in Littleton. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
I've been in the restaurant business for 20 years and have tried to, you know, figure out who's had too much, who can maybe have one more. Train the staff. We've all taken training through the New Hampshire State Liquor Commission, which does a great job. But they slip between the cracks. Or maybe they're on coke or something and they're acting more sober. Or maybe they know how to act sober. And then once you relax a little bit, then you see they've had too much to drink. But the blame all comes back on the restaurateur. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, gentlemen, but in most of the civilized world, it's the patron who's responsible. And shouldn't that be who is ultimately responsible and not the person that's serving him?
Wayne, thanks for the question. And Jim Reams, I'll go to you.
Well, the short answer is that everybody has a role to play here. The people that sell alcohol are held to a standard that hasn't changed over the years. They've always been held responsible for making sure they didn't serve intoxicated people, for example. And I sympathize with Wayne because it can be difficult, which is why the only ones that we've actually prosecuted are the outrageous cases. And we've said to each of the bars and restaurants, we could put you out of business under the liquor laws of this state. But we haven't done that. We're trying to, you know, raise awareness in the industry. And we certainly got the attention of the Restaurant Association as soon as the first indictment came down. But everybody has a role to play in this. And, you know, the people that are selling alcohol, whether it's the State Liquor Commission or a restaurant and bar, has a role to play. And that role hasn't changed. What has changed is sort of the ability to prosecute the outrageous cases.
Bob?
Well, I was going to say there are certain positions in our society that have what I would call gatekeeper functions. And, for example, as a director of a impaired driver intervention program, several different models, before a person receives a completion certificate, I personally have to sign off on that. And any case that goes through your office, Jim, I'm sure you have to sign off on, or most of them, if not all. And so I have a role to evaluate that and say, whether I like it or not, in this case, and there are many difficult judgment cases, I have to make that call. And I think restaurant owners and bartenders and others, by definition, take that role.
Well, Wayne, good to hear from you. And again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. To Jackie next in Wilton. Hi, Jackie. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just have a comment to share that really changed my perspective. I lived in Norway in the early 70s when I was in college, and I found that the culture there had zero tolerance. When anyone was going out drinking, there was always someone who didn't drink at all, who would drive people home, or you took a taxi, or you spent the night. And I found that profoundly changed my whole attitude about how we as a culture need to ask those questions. How do we address this responsibly, not just for the people who are choosing to drink, but for those of us who can support a healthier behavior all around?
So absolute zero tolerance in Norway, you found, Jackie,
and
ways to get around it. I wonder, was it a little easier, Jackie, because in most European countries, you know, you're living in cities and you can walk or take a train or take a cab?
I'm sure that has an effect. I lived in the country.
Uh-huh.
The reason I called in is that I feel like as we need to look to other societies and question how have they addressed this in a way that has been more responsible or has worked for them.
Well, thanks for the call, Jackie. And it raises the point, Jim Reams, that you brought up before, that you said other societies, even other states, do a better job. I just want to add in on to Jackie's call, an email from Teresa, with no public transportation to speak of in New Hampshire, how many options honestly exist. So kind of if you could address how other societies, maybe even other states, do this better. And I'd like to hear from you too, Representative Thal.
Well, the whole issue is fairly complex, I think. I've been a real critic of the system because, as I've said, it doesn't take this seriously enough. But what we need to do is sort of the stick and the carrot. I think the stick needs to be bigger, but we have to have the carrot as well. The state of Texas, if you're a multiple offender and under the right circumstances, you can get life in prison for, you know, your 10th DWI. We have one here in New Hampshire serving, I don't know, 2 to 5 or something like that. But the difference is the life in prison in Texas, if you do their intensive one-year program, then you can get paroled. And they use the big stick, but they have the carrot and the program to back it up. And they've found that that's been successful in cutting down, you know, highway deaths. And we need to do that. You know, as Jackie said, the Scandinavian countries particularly treat it very harshly if you drink and drive over there. I think, if I remember correctly, the first offense in Sweden is a year in jail.
Wow, that's a big difference from what we do here.
And guess what they don't have? They don't have drunks on the highways. They may have a designated driver. And we're seeing some of that in New Hampshire. I did a sobriety checkpoint in Auburn a couple summers ago, and the car rolled up, and the smell of alcohol on an August night was pervasive. And the driver said to us, there were 6 people in the car, "I'm the designated driver. What you smell is everybody else." And we got him out of the car, and he walked over, and he was right. He passed every sobriety thing that the police had. And when he got away from the car, you could smell he didn't have alcohol on him. You know, that's the kind of behavior we want to encourage.
What do you think, Representative Thal? In Sweden, I think it was, you said, Jim, a year in jail for your first offense. Why don't we do that here?
I don't think the public would put up with it, to be honest with you. I think the attitudes in Europe towards drinking are much more refined, much more willing to support the strict enforcement. And I agree that some of the penalties we have aren't good enough. For example, currently we only have a felony level for fourth offense. I have been working for years to try and get it down to third.
Now let me get that straight. Felony means jail time, serious penalties, and so forth.
I mean state prison time.
State prison time.
That's correct.
So fourth offense, state prison time. Third offense, maybe some prison time, maybe not?
It's usually county jail time, 30 days, something like that.
Representative Thal is correct. I mean, here you have somebody who has to commit 3 DWIs before they're even looking at the possibility of prison. 3 DWIs is a serious alcohol problem in anybody's book.
Right, you
and
could kill somebody.
So you have somebody who has a real problem and is dangerous every day to the rest of us, and we need to deal with that problem and give them one more chance for the fourth DWI before we get serious about it. Really doesn't make any sense.
Go ahead, Representative.
And you have to also understand that that's the third time they're caught. Just because you catch them 3 times doesn't mean they haven't been out there 50 or 60 times.
Right.
So what should we do, in your opinion, Representative Thal? You're saying the public won't support a year in the slammer first offense. What should we do that might, open people's eyes that they really shouldn't do this?
Well, some of the things we're trying to do is we're trying to get an interlock, one of the advanced technology interlock, which can be, well, the way the laws are right now, an aggravated or second offense, you have to have it. First offense, you can have it if the court feels it's necessary.
This is the thing you have to breathe on before you can get your car to start. Is that right?
That's correct. Currently, the interlock we have right now, you don't get the data for 60 days because they drive, they have it downloaded and certified every 60 days. The device we're looking at now is a real-time device. It takes a picture of the individual who is driving the car when they blow into the device. It sends it automatically to a server, and it tells you where it is.
Now, couldn't I, let's say that I've got a couple DWIs, couldn't I just get, Bob to start my car for me and drive it down the block and then we switch seats?
Right now, that's the way it is, because if you recall, there was a conviction for a woman from Merrimack who had her daughter blow into it twice so that she could drive the car and take her to school. She was a teacher. This past December, her interlock period expired, and she was just recently arrested for DWI driving a taxi. So that's a serious thing. And there's a bill to address that in the legislature, which I'm a co-sponsor of. We have several bills. I think the advanced interlock has the ability to modify behavior because it gives you the results in real time, and you can track it.
What do you think, Bob, about the discussion raised by Jackie and by our emailer, Teresa, about public transportation? Teresa, again, saying there's no public transportation to speak of in New Hampshire. How many options exist?
Well, I think there's some validity to that point, but I think responsible people find ways to obtain transportation or frankly, deal with any situations. I mean, when you think about it, all of that applies to virtually everything in New Hampshire. You have to go longer distances. There's a population of people that I deal with in treatment, for example, and you'll say, I'd like you to go to 3 self-help meetings a week. A person that's motivated will find a way to go there. A person that's not will find a million explanations why they can't.
So the lack of transportation is not a good excuse.
I think it's a factor, but it's not a compelling factor per se.
All right. Well, we will talk more after a short break and take more of your calls at 1-800-892-6477.
Ira Flatto, host of Science Friday, doesn't shy away from the big questions.
So does America need to produce more scientists and engineers?
Let's talk about
signs of an early spring, that we humans have more in common with gorillas than we think.
And where does the dark energy live?
I'm Brady Carlson. Join me as I sit down with Ira to discuss scientific questions of all kinds. We'll be at UNH Durham on May 1st. For tickets and information, visit nhpr.org.
This event sponsored in part by NEBCO and the University of New Hampshire.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Woodstock Inn Station and Brewery, now offering its signature oatmeal stout and last chair ale in 22-ounce bottles at local stores. Details at WoodstockInnNH.com. And from Lang McLowry Spearer Real Estate and its affiliate, Lyon and Davis Fine Properties, announcing their 15th office at the Powerhouse Mall in the Upper Valley, West Lebanon, New Hampshire. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about drunk driving, a longtime problem that's received renewed attention in an extensive union leaders series this month. Let's get your thoughts into our conversation, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page and join the conversation there. And our guests are Representative John Thal, a Republican from Whitefield, Jim Reams, Rockingham County's attorney, and Bob Kelly, director of the Amethyst Foundation. And gentlemen, before we go to our listeners, I want to address again this issue of treatment. And Bob Kelly, we started out talking about treatment, even though the impression is that a lot of these first-time offenders are just people who made a bad mistake at a bachelor party, for example. You seem to be saying, no, a lot of these folks, even the first-time offenders, need some serious alcohol abuse treatment.
Well, yes, and to be honest, it's not just me that's saying it. It's the national studies, and as you can see, the listeners can't see, but I have all sorts of papers in front of me. But we're not dealing with anymore with that population. That was in the 70s and 80s. Those people got the message, so to speak, and we
when
no longer...
When you say those people, I'm sorry to interrupt, when you say those people...
The social drinkers who made a mistake.
Right. They will these days take a cab or designate a driver. Public education has worked for those folks.
We rarely see those in our system,
yeah. So here's the question for all of you, and I'll start with you, Bob. Is there enough treatment?
No, in a word. But the bill that Attorney Thole and others, House Bill 283, have proposed... makes a radical change in the delivery of DWI services. And it, are you comfortable with me summarizing it? I realize that's somewhat dangerous, but it's what it's saying is we're going to evaluate people at the beginning, and we're going to determine the level of problem you have, and then we're going to.
Upon conviction.
Immediately upon conviction, you have to submit to this evaluation process and then begin your treatment. Now, there are financial impediments, of course, but there's also a grant that the state has called the Access to Recovery Grant, and that grant is available. There are limitations, of course, eligibility requirements, but that grant gives people up to 9 sessions if they qualify for treatment. So I think that bill, which is saying we're going to get treatment sooner and the access to recovery, is going to have a positive impact. Does that mean there are not people that are going to slip through the cracks? Of course not. They're always going to be them. The trick, and I don't want to dominate this, is that the population we're dealing with, I mean, I believe we have to educate the clinicians who are going to be doing both the evaluation and the treatment to recognize what the population they're dealing with is. They're very good manipulators. They're very untruthful. They have what I would call, it's not sociopathy, but it's certainly a behavioral pattern that's identified that is very adept at manipulating the system.
That's probably why some of them have 5, 6, 7, 8 convictions.
Well,
they're good liars.
That and the profile, which is a person who takes risky behaviors, is less likely to have internalized locus of control, less likely to follow rules in general, lower education levels, which aren't a negative in and of themselves, but indicate someone that doesn't follow through on things.
Okay, and one more question before we go back to our listeners. For you, Representative Thole, so the legislature has been very concerned, as you well know, about the budget and trying to spend less and shrink government. So in that context, is there money to expand treatment for DWI offenders?
There's a grant that he talked about, and we're obviously looking for funding in any way we can. Some of the programs we had in the past were self-funded by the participants, and those really didn't work because people didn't pay, and it became a burden. Whether or not we're going to find the money, I don't know. Obviously, I'm going to be trying to do everything I can because I believe this is a very serious issue. I've been involved in the program for a long time, not just this, but with mental health and other things. And they're all intermixed. They all work together. People with mental problems tend to self-medicate. So we run into those people. 283, the House Bill 283 is a start. It was put together by a committee of the legislature and people who are clinicians and every law enforcement and everybody else to try and get it done the right way. For example, it calls for, when practical, to have an arraignment on a DWI charge within 14 days, where before sometimes it would take 6 weeks or 2 months before the person's arraigned.
Really? So they could go out and drive drunk again?
That's correct.
All right, well, let's go back to our listeners, and Susan's waiting in Peterborough. Susan, you're on the air. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura. I am a person whose grandfather was killed by a drunk driver. My father was 10 years old, so believe me, I understand the pain of this that goes through the generation.
Wow, Susan, that's awful. Your poor dad, especially.
Yeah, my father, yes. I then became an administrator of an alcoholism program in Massachusetts, where today, for even a first offender, young drunk driver, that conviction will follow him into the workplace. And what we found in our program is if you can take that young man and he can work, that made a very significant difference, along with treatment, of course, mandatory treatment. So point one, let's look at the way our system works and not penalize first-time offenders by making it harder for them to work. Point two, as I'm listening to you this morning, I'm on Route 101 headed to Nashua, and I was almost rammed at least three times by road-raising tailgaters. Drunk driving is part, in my opinion, of an overall attitude in this country that you get in that car and you do what you want as long as there's not a policeman around to stop you. So in my view, it's my understanding that more accidents are caused by aggressive driving than drunk driving, and I think we have to take a look at the whole thing and make it a general campaign of responsibility on the road.
Right. And Susan, for the purposes of today, we're not talking about distracted driving or aggressive driving, but those are issues that have come up on this program before. But Jim Reams, what about her earlier point about the way we treat first-time offenders?
Well, Bob sort of alluded to this a little bit when he was talking about treatment. I have friends and family members who are alcoholics, and most of them have gone through the cure, but I have some that have gone through the cure multiple times because they have not.
In other words, they weren't cured.
Right. They have not made the commitment to stop drinking. Not one of those people was ever arrested for a DWI. And they were raging alcoholics, and a couple of them still are.
Did they have a habit of getting in their cars? I mean, you could be an alcoholic and just sit at home.
They did not have a habit of driving for some reason, and maybe it's the change in attitudes from, if you look at Mad Men on television in the 60s, everybody was drinking at work. And the way alcohol and cigarettes were treated in the 60s are very different from today. But, first-time offenders can be raging alcoholics nonetheless. We have to be able to sort them out, and Bob and treatment providers think that they have the ability to do that to some degree, not 100% accurate, obviously, but they can weed them out with some of the programs that they have and try and, devote services to those people.
Representative Thole.
Yeah, I have been an opponent of not letting work licenses be out because right now the chances of violating them are so great.
Now, what does that mean exactly? You get a license to drive just to work.
Just to work. And,
yeah.
And I've been against that because there's no way to track it.
No, and you can stretch the definition of work any
right.
way you want.
Now, under this new technology we have right now called the it's an interlock, but it's advanced technology, that device has the ability to geotrack. In other words, you can program the system so that you can only go certain places in certain ways and certain times. And if we can get that device in common use in the state of New Hampshire, I am more than willing to support giving somebody a work license that has that device so that they can keep their families working and do things. But yet it will make sure that they don't violate the use of the license.
All right. Well, let's get some more calls in if we could. And here's Bill in Lee. Hi, Bill. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Bill. And I just wanted to make the point that alcoholism is categorized by the AMA as a disease. You can be a recovering alcoholic and you can be a practicing alcoholic. There's a difference. If you're a recovering alcoholic, you want help, and you go through either AA or a program with a person who probably has experience as an alcoholic himself. That's where you get the most help. A person that's not a recovering alcoholic is going to do anything to get a drink. He's going to get behind the wheel. He's going to sacrifice his wife. He's going to sacrifice his family. Doesn't matter. He'll be there waiting at 9 in the morning at a liquor store waiting for it to open up. As far as I think the best thing is treatment and punishment is one as a combination. And I have one more point I want to bring up is the New Hampshire state of New Hampshire has a monopoly on the liquor store industry in New Hampshire on the highways and everything else. And I kind of find it paradoxical that they want to sell all this alcohol. They have 77 outlets of whatever, 55 outlets in the state. And at the same time, they want to crack down.
You know, this has been noted before. I wonder what you think, Bob Kelly. You know, don't drink and drive. But by the way, here's this huge barn right on the side of Interstate 93 where you can buy whatever you need in terms of alcohol.
I think we all have concerns about that. And I think we'd all be frauds if we said we didn't. But one of the points that the caller made, I think it's Bill, is that the alcoholic who's at the liquor store at 9 o'clock in the morning as soon as it opens. But what the research has shown repeatedly, and this is internationally, is that it's not just alcoholism that's the risk factor, that it's a population of people, some of whom are, a great percentage of whom are alcoholics, but more importantly, the issues that have been addressed by several callers, the societal implications, what's acceptable, but their own personal characteristics, mental health disorders, risk-taking behaviors, those kinds. So it's a subcategory of alcoholics, and there are many alcoholics who are receptive to treatment. There are many who aren't that don't drive drunk. And our goal, and I hope as this House bill goes through and the training of counselors goes through, that we are able to identify that high-risk population. There's an instrument. It's called the DWIR, and it's developed by this group through federal probation. And it identifies the seven domains, they call them, of the person most likely to reoffend. And that's, in my opinion, what we as clinicians and treatment providers have to do a better job of, is providing effective treatment within the limited resources that we have. And we all agree they're very limited.
You know, Jim Reams, as we talk about alcoholism and people who need treatment and so forth, and that's all understood and so forth, but we're also talking about people, alcoholic or not, who make the decision to put other people's lives in danger. By focusing on, you know, they've got a disease and they need treatment, are we getting people off the hook?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think that...
I mean, yes, I'm sorry you have a problem with alcohol, but look, you can't go out and kill an innocent person. Right. I mean, that's another step above.
Right. That's our, you know, sort of your classic alcohol problem driver, that, you know, the multiple offender, the numbers that shock people is how many people have multiple convictions.
Even a first-time offender could kill somebody.
They could. You know, that's part of the reason why we had the big St. Patrick's Day crackdown in Rockingham County, was to try and get people's attention. And, you know, thankfully, we didn't have one major collision during that weekend, which is pretty amazing to us. And the police saw more cabs and more limos on the highway than they'd ever seen, to the point where it was noticeable to them, which we thought was a great testament to the success of the advertising and sort of the noise that we made.
Is there a legal reason why, Jim, those sobriety checkpoints, by the way, have to be so widely advertised? You know, you'll see in the newspaper, sobriety checkpoint on, you know, I-89 on Labor Day weekend. Do they have to advertise that?
Yes, by law we have to advertise it.
Because it seems like it's saying to the drunk driver, okay, just take another route.
Well, it really is. Well, we don't tell them exactly where it's going to be. So we say we're going to have one in Portsmouth this summer, and we will. But we're not going to tell people in advance where it's going to be. But it doesn't take very long for it to get down to the bars from their friends. But the part of it's the PR campaign to, you know, warn people, listen, you know, take a designated driver or a cab.
What do you think about that question that I just asked Jim Reams, Representative Thal? Again, you know, we're talking about people needing treatment, having all sorts of issues, understandable, but again, you know, it's like driving around with shooting a gun at people when you're driving drunk in a car. You could kill someone, you could kill lots of people. Are we getting tough enough?
I think we're trying to do the right thing. I think we're working in that way. I find that, especially dealing with the legislature, it's really hard to make drastic major changes all at once. Very often we have to settle for small steps. We've been making small steps. We've got some, I think, some good legislation in the pipeline right now. And I think that 283 is going to go a long way. There are some other interlock
bills.
The
yeah.
bill. There's some other interlock bills are going to help to do that. It's going to take public awareness and the public desire to stop this, because those of us who pass laws are the representatives of the people, and if they don't want it, we can't do it.
What do you think, Bob?
Well, I think that the New Hampshire does a great job, first of all. MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, rates New Hampshire as number 9 in the country in effectiveness in dealing with this problem.
Really?
So, correct. So it's not I don't want to give the impression, neither do either of either Representative Thole or Jim Reams, that we're not doing a good job. What we're talking about is taking a very, very good system and improving it and making it even more effective. So, I think the legislature has already done a very good job.
All right. Well, we'll close on that. And Bob Kelly, thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks very much.
That's Bob Kelly, director of the Amethyst Foundation, a nonprofit that offers substance abuse education, intervention, and evaluation. Representative Thole, thank you for making the time.
My pleasure.
That's Representative John Thole, New Hampshire Republican from Whitefield and a former state trooper. Jim Reams, it was good to see you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me back.
Jim Reams, Rockingham County Attorney and President of the National District Attorneys Association. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.